Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is novelist Richard Ford, winner of the 2017 Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award, given by the Tulsa Library Trust and the Tulsa City County Library. Ford is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 7 novels and 5 story collections, 4 of which chronicle the life of his character Frank Bascom, a writer turned sports writer turned real estate agent. The Sports Writer, Independence Day, The Lay of the Land, and Let Me Be Frank With You portray a middle-class contemporary American life with poignancy and humor. Independence Day was the first book to receive both the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award. His other noted works include the New York Times bestseller Canada and his short story collections Rock Springs and A Multitude of Sins. His latest book, released earlier this year, is Ford's first nonfiction book, a loving memoir of his parents titled Between Them, Remembering My Parents. It's published by Echo. He'll be receiving the Helmrich Award this Friday, and there'll be a free public presentation Saturday morning at 10:30 at Central Library, where he'll speak and sign books. Richard Ford is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Richard Ford, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's nice to get to talk to you.
And congratulations on the Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award. It's richly deserved.
Well, thank you. It's an honor for Christina and me to get to come to Tulsa. I'm a child of the library, and I'm a child of the library in Mississippi, and I've been pretty much a child of the library every place I've ever lived. So it's an honor to get to do anything to be part of the library's mission.
So I want to ask about your latest book, Between Them. You've turned to nonfiction and the story of your parents' lives, their memoirs written over the course of 30 years. The second half of the book, My Mother in Memory, was written several years after your mother's death in the early 80s. But the first memoir, Gone Remembering My Father, is recent, just a few years ago. What made you decide to write about your father, considering it was some 30 years after his death?
In some ways, it was just that I had written about my mother and thought that I was happy to have done that. And I sort of looked around in 1985 or 6 when I wrote it, and I thought, well, you had a father, too. So some sense of symmetry, I think, provoked me. But then my father was somebody whom I realized I missed, even as old as I was then, and went on missing for the last years, and so I wrote about him in a way to bring him closer to me through the act of writing. And I thought, too, Rich, my parents were quite ordinary people in the sense that they didn't make a lot of things happen, except me, and I'm an only child, and they were, you know, not wealthy, they were not influential, they were not very consequential in life, and yet being their son was for me a remarkable experience because they loved me as much as they did, and I loved them as much as I did, and we were the way we were. And I just thought, you know, these ordinary people, given that they had a son who turns out to be a writer, deserves for me some extra thought. And I thought I could maybe write about them in a way, my father and then my mother, to try to find a virtue in the life that we lived. And it was most, I suppose, demanding of me to write about my father because he was a traveling salesman and was gone from the house a lot. And then in 1960, he died. And then he was gone from me ever after that. So I thought it was a kind of a writerly challenge because there was a disconnect between how I felt about him, which was very strong, and exactly how much, you know, experience I had with him.
I think one of the most remarkable feats about this book is your ability to, the only way I can describe it is the ability to detach yourself from being the star of their lives, which I think is very common for most children when they're talking about their parents. And in fact, of course, you write that their happiest time in their life was before your birth, when they traveled together on your father's sales route. Was that a difficult thing to acknowledge?
Well, it was not anything that I had thought about until I started writing about my father, and then I did think about it, and I thought, oh, good. There's a virtue that I can say that I've been able to pronounce, that I was third among the three of us. It may be generational. It may just be a product of modernity that children now are the stars in the family. I think it wasn't always that way in and family lives, American family lives and otherwise. I think, and for me, it was consoling to know that my mother and my father loved each other as much as they did, and that I was, in fact, admitted into their love as a third party. And it was never discomforting to discover that, and I know when I was living it without ever conceptualizing it, that it was never uncomfortable. I liked it. I liked the way in which their love kind of surrounded me, but did not exclude each other.
What was their life like then when they were traveling together? It sounds like it was a pretty idyllic portion of their life, that they were very happy living together, basically on the road most of the time, most weeks. Mm-hmm. They had weekends home at an apartment, but that wasn't home. The car was home in the sense that they were going from place to place. He was selling starch. He was a starch salesman. Right. And she would wait in the car, and their life was really about the time on the road.
That's right. Exactly so. I mean, of course, I wasn't there, so there's a certain amount of supposition going on, but the supposition is based on how they were together after I was born and could observe them. And they were together. They were jolly people. They were volatile. They liked to have a drink. They liked to have a good time. They liked to dance. And I know for a fact that when my father was traveling for the Faultless Starch Company out of Kansas City, that they had enough money, they had a car, they didn't have any health problems. It just seemed to make sense to me that they probably just loved it, because my father liked being on the road, and my mother liked being with my father. I think when they met each other in Hot Springs or around Hot Springs, Arkansas, in 1927 or so, they just fell together is what they did. I think my mother, who had had a not particularly easy life, saw in my father a kind of a salvation. And then when my father saw my mother, he just saw the most beautiful girl he'd ever meet. And so they just were made for each other.
I was interested in your descriptions of your father, because you said he was sort of self-effacing, sort of in the background. But he had to be a very gregarious man to be a salesman. It seems to be there were a bit of a contradictions there.
Well, that wouldn't be the first contradiction, would it? You know, I don't know if a person who is a salesman and who seems to be gregarious would necessarily need to be a natural salesman or naturally gregarious. You just make yourself that way in order to do your job. And that was the requirement of the job, for him to go into these wholesale grocer companies all across the South and to make himself basically part of what he sold. And I don't mean by that he was a falsifying person. He wasn't a falsifying person. He just loved his job. He thought the product that he sold was worth buying and worth selling, and he put himself forward in behalf of doing that.
And you said, he had no committed interest or enthusiasm apart from work and the two of you.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, you know, my father was not what you would have called a well-rounded person. I think the notion of well-rounded may also be generational. He had a job, and that was the most important thing for earning his keep. And he had my mother, whom he adored, and he had me, whom he loved, and that was it. I mean, the notion that he should tie flies or be a sort of at-home weekend carpenter or learn to play chess, that just wasn't in the picture.
One of the other things I was getting from reading the book was there's a sense that you said, you know, I had this ordinary life, I was loved, it was a great childhood, yet your father was gone most of the time, and of course, you know, he was gone completely at age 16, and he was the type of father who, I don't want to say he didn't make up for lost time on the weekends when he was there, but he was not the guy that would take you fishing or teach you to build a treehouse in the back. He was, you know, he was utterly useless around the house from what you write. And yet you said we had this normal relationship, but I gathered in between, were there times where you felt like he was not enough in your life, or was just that was the way it was, and so that was the way it was?
I think window number two. that was the way it was. Conventional wisdom about family life, and this is the reason that you write a memoir, conventional wisdom about family life sometimes betrays us. We are made to think that we are, in fact, unhappy when, indeed, we are happy. We are made to think that we should want something which, in fact, we may not want. I knew my father was not around because other fathers were around. And yet, they were happy. And when I was alone with my mother, I only had her to contend with, although she was a considerable person to contend with, volatile, as I said before. But I mean, you know, to be a sort of obstreperous young boy as I was, dyslexic, not good at school, not easily supervised, to have one parent not there a lot of the time, that ain't so bad. I just had one person fewer than I had to elude.
One of the things I took away from this, your family comes from Western Arkansas. I think your father comes from just east of Russellville, and your mother came from the far northwestern corner of Arkansas, just across
Benton
the border from Benton County, just across from Oklahoma.
Exactly.
I think a lot of Oklahomans will recognize a lot about them in their lives. And this was the thing I came away, and it also informs your fiction. You know, their lives at times were hard and difficult, but there was this optimism, genuine happiness, and a matter-of-fact acceptance to make the best of their lives. And I think that sort of informs a lot of your writing.
It probably is true. It probably is true. I mean, my parents, in any large-scale way, were not aspirational. They sort of played the cards they were dealt. And they didn't. Much of unhappiness, it seems to me, comes from a sense of frustration. Much of it comes from the sense that we either deserve or want something that we are not getting. They just didn't feel that way because my father was raised the son of a suicide in a small Arkansas town. My mother bounced around quite a lot in her teenage years. I think that the life that they made between the two of them, and then subsequently with me, was for them so much a better life than they ever thought they were going to end up with. So they were quite happy to live the lives that they lived. So sometimes my friends who were my generation will say to me, your parents' lives seem to me unhappy. And I think, well, you're just imposing your own set of values on my book and onto my parents. Don't do that. You know, you're in a way, you're derailing my effort to tell you the truth.
Yeah. In many ways, you said they were absolutely normal, but it just reminds us that every life is extraordinary in its own way, I think. In many ways.
Well, it's at least worth noticing.
Right? Yeah.
You know, I mean the very fact of their smallness and their lack of great consequence in life is, for me, and I think I make this, try to make this point in the book, it's a bit like Chekhov in a way. You look at people whom you otherwise wouldn't look at on an ordinary day, and what you see there are both the things you expect to see and things that you don't expect to see. And so, in looking at my parents in this way, through the lens of my memory, I see much that I didn't expect to see. I find virtue there where I didn't expect to find it.
I have a lot of empathy for your mother. Your mother had a very difficult life growing up, and many times during her life, her mother, her own mother, I guess, had your mother very young. In fact, at some point, she wished to be referred to as your mother's sister rather than
Correct.
Her mother.
Correct.
And that seems like that was a very fraught relationship. And your father's mother was also, seems like, a never trusted, I guess, disapproved of the marriage.
Well, she was suspicious of my mother, that I know, because my mother spent some time in the convent of St. Anne, which is now gone from Fort Smith, but she went to school in Fort Smith at the convent. And because my grandmother was Irish Protestant from County Cavan, I think she always thought my mother was Catholic. And then they just weren't going to tell her that she was really a Catholic. So, man, I don't know that she disapproved of the marriage so much as that she was just a little bit standoffish about my mother, whom she couldn't quite get in focus. And I mean, but again, you know, how often does that happen? You know, I think it happens probably in northwest Arkansas and northeast Oklahoma quite a lot.
Getting back to this idea that you detached yourself from the story of your parents' life, was how you discovered books and how books became important in your life. And I was struck by one small sentence in your father's story in which you said, you know, I can't even remember him reading a book with me or telling me to read a book at one point. So I began wondering, where did your own love of books begin?
Well, to some extent, Rich, it's a simple mystery which will never be plumbed. But my mother read books, and I was, as I said before, dyslexic and decidedly did not read books. But I saw her reading books, you know. I saw that happening. I saw her sitting aside from what we were doing and doing that. And then she used to also take me to the library in Jackson, Mississippi. And as I'll say when I talk to the audience in Tulsa, just being in the presence of books which you could see adults admired and were precious and that were preserved for people in the library had a lot to do with just my recognizing that the object of a book was an object of adoration by people. And then, of course, being in Jackson, Mississippi, there was Eudora Welty. And Eudora created in the air of Mississippi, and particularly in Jackson and Faulkner, too, up the road, an air in which books were important and people who wrote books were plausible people. And so I think, in a way, I kind of backed into reading the same way I described backing into being a writer. They were just around. Books were around. And I was also quite ashamed of myself for being such a terrible student. And my teachers were always saying to me, you know, they didn't know I was dyslexic. They would always say, you just need to try a little harder. And so at some point along the way, I thought to myself, well, maybe they're right. You know, maybe your teachers are right. Maybe what you need to do is try a little harder. So I tried a little harder, and lo and behold, what I tried to do was what was right in front of me, which was to read books.
My guest today is Richard Ford, the writer and novelist. His latest book is titled Between Them, Remembering My Parents. It's a memoir of his parents. He'll be receiving the Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award for 2017. The public presentation and signing will take place Saturday morning at 10:30 at Central Library. Best known for his Frank Bascom, now quartet of books, The Sports Writer, Independence Day, which won the Pulitzer Prize, The Lay of the Land, and Let Me Be Frank With You. Frank Bascom, tell us a little bit about this character. How did he come to you originally, and did you expect to spend a good part of your writing life writing about him?
I did not. When I started writing, Frank Bascom was in 1982, living in Princeton, New Jersey. And I was at that time, that was would have been the third book I ever wrote. I thought I was a guy who wrote one book and then one book and then one book and then one book. It never occurred to me that I would write books which were connected. That I didn't think I had that kind of ambition as a writer. I learned that I could have that ambition when that book both pleased me to write and found a readership. I was interested in when I dreamed Frank up, in finding a character who could combine two qualities that I thought were not, that I hadn't successfully combined in the books that I had written before then. One was that he could be brainy, and he could say he could be smart. And the other thing was that he could be visceral and funny. And I wanted to try to find a way of telling a story with a narrator who would be those two things at the same time. And I had a lot of good models for myself as a writer. I had Walker Percy's wonderful novel, The Movie Gore. I had Joe Heller's wonderful novel called Something Happened. And I had Fred Exley's wonderful book. I don't know if it's a novel or not. I'm not sure what it is. It's called A Fan's Notes. And those three books kind of circulated around in my thinking for the years prior to starting writing The Sports Writer and finally contributed to my being able to unite into one character who turned out to be Frank Bascom. Those two qualities, to be smart, to tell you things you didn't know, and to also amuse.
But he also has that sports writer's eye, the keen observer. He's observing everything and relating, at least in The Sports Writer, he's almost has a sports writer approach. It's a very, I mean, there are some long sentences, but it's also very, there's much of the prose is very punchy, you know, sort of like a sports writer in some senses. Was that intentional?
I had been a sports writer.
Right.
And
right.
Prior to that. And so I had an idea, again, of combining two kinds of sentence styles. One which was punchy and one which would be plausible as the voice and lingo of a sports writer, and one which was somewhat more elusive and right. was somewhat more periodic in my sentences. So, again, I was, you know, as is often the case when you're writing novels, you're trying to combine things in a way that have never been combined before. I mean, Ruskin says composition is the arrangement of unequal things, and I was trying to combine and arrange unequal things.
What about the decision to go back to him and write about him the second time in Independence Day? Was that a was that just something that you said, I want to know what this guy's doing now?
No.
I read something where you said, you know, the characters, whatever I decide to make him at that, the particular point I decide to make him, he's not a full-formed person. It's whatever I decide on him. I thought that was really interesting because you hear so many writers talk about these characters as if they're a real person and a living, breathing person that's inhabits their mind. And I thought that was an interesting insight.
Well, when writers say that, they're just trying to elude responsibility for their own mistakes, by and large. It's just baloney. Of course, it's baloney. But to answer your first question, I wrote Independence Day the way I've pretty much done about 80% of the things in my life. I just got lucky and backed into it because I thought I was writing a book about a man, and I didn't know who the man was or who the son was, who takes his son to the Baseball Hall of Fame to try to, in a way, reaffiliate with his son. And I kept finding in my notebook, because I keep a notebook for everything, all kinds of sentences which sounded to me like Frank Bascom out of the first novel. And I thought, oh, man, don't do that. Don't write another book that Frank Bascom tells, because if you do that, you're just going to repeat the first book. And you're just a guy trying to, you know, write his first book over again. But ultimately, I thought, gee, you know, you've got a voice here, and you've got it not only a voice, but it's a pliable, plausible voice that readers have shown they want to hear. So why are you resisting this? You've been given this great beginning. You can write the first three sentences of the book, and everybody who read The Sports Writer is going to think, oh, yeah, good, I like that. So I just thought, don't resist your fate.
Well, it's, of course, it turned into three novels, and then after everyone thought you were done, and I think you thought you were done, let me be frank with you.
Right. Hurricane Sandy came along, and Christina and I, my wife and I, were down in New Jersey, kind of just looking at the aftermath of the hurricane. And on the way up from central New Jersey back up to New York, where we were teaching at Columbia, I started getting sentences in my head. You could, you know, a sentence that Frank would say again. Here's another sound-oriented impulse. I could hear Frank saying these things, and I thought, well, why are you stopping here now? Do this. Sit down and write a story. So I sat down and wrote one story, and then one led to another.
And they seem to close out the year and close out the story of Frank Bascom, I guess, because The Sports Writer, I think, starts around Easter, Independence Day around the 4th of July, The Lay of the Land in the fall, and now, Let Me Be Frank With You, is in December.
Christmas. I have Valentine's Day lurking. lurking in the wings here, Rich. I'm not sure I have the chops for it, but I've got about 4 years worth of a novel which would be called Be Mine, which is set in Valentine's Day. All I have to do is just find the energy to write it.
Yeah, I want to go back to Between Them. You know,
sure.
What I found really interesting was your role as an observer, much as Frank Bascom is observing his life, as much as he's telling us about what happens in his life. And there was one story, though, that I feel like there was like this really serious sense of regret. Your mother, when she got ill, prior to getting ill, she had attended her mother's own decline and death, and that had been a really bad experience, bitter experience, I think is how you'd...
That's right.
And she said that she didn't want you to do the same for her. There was a moment near the end where she briefly opened the door to coming to live with you and spend her last days. And you said something, you felt that you said something that closed that door. Is that a big regret for you? Can you describe that scene? Can you describe what happened?
I will, and then I'll tell you whether I regret it or not. My mother and I were sitting together. This is in October of 1982. I had rented a house in Vermont, and she was up to visit and was clearly declining. And she said to me, Richard, she said, I think I'm not going to be able to take care of myself pretty soon. And I said, well, Mother, I said, if that's the case, I said, then come and live with Christina and me. And she said, well, could I really do that? And I said, absolutely, yes, you could. Yes, you can. She said, all right, then. She said, then I think that I'll do that. She said, I'll start changing the course of my life so that I can do that. And I said at that moment, I said, well, don't make such big changes yet. We don't know what's going to happen. Just don't make those changes yet. And she looked at me, and when she had a kind of light in her eyes before, when I had told her she could come and live with us, I saw that light in her eyes. I thought, go out. And I think she realized that, or she believed anyway, that I thought she wasn't going to be around much longer, and that I didn't want her to prepare herself to come and live with us because she wasn't going to be alive. For myself, I don't know what I believed. I wanted my mother to survive. I don't know that I thought she would live 3 months longer, 6 months longer, a year longer. I just don't quite know what sponsored that remark of mine, but I wish I hadn't said it. And I think there's something different in me because I'm telling this for the benefit of the reader, making a specimen of myself. I'd like to say that there's something different between doing something that you wish you hadn't done and something that you're going to regret all your life.
Yeah, it was a very emotional part of the read, and there were many emotional sections. Your father's death, your mother's reaction to your father's death, which I thought was really, again, getting back to that idea of observer, your father passed away at home. You tried to resuscitate him, and your mother basically went hysterical, but it was a hysterics in the sense of just beside herself and just repeating, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no, over and over again. I don't know if you actually wrote this, or maybe it's something I surmised through the subtext, was that this is real life. You know, so many times you see this episode in novels and films and everything else, and it's very dramatic, yet there was a sense of real life that far transcends anything that people can ever dream to write up or, you know, film or shoot or whatever about.
That's why I wrote it in a memoir. That's why I wrote it in a memoir. I didn't think that the apparatus of fiction and of artifice was necessary. I'm just going to tell you what happened, and that will have to reside as a fact in your reader's experience. But it wasn't not survivable. It was entirely survivable. Its consequences were as dramatic as the events themselves. I mean, when my father died in my arms in 1960, again, that was a parent that wasn't there anymore, and more of my life was returned to me to make my decisions for myself. My mother and I basically became partners after that in her life and in mine, and life became a little bit freer. I was a long time getting myself reconciled to that odd feeling of being freed when my father died. It seemed to me to be something that I was feeling that was wrong and that I was bad for feeling it. And yet, over the course of time, I've come to realize that there is no bad, there is no good in that. It's just what happens.
Richard, thank you very much for joining us.
Been really nice to talk to you, Rich. Thanks for taking the time.
Writer Richard Ford speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmrick Distinguished Author Award. He'll receive the award this weekend and have a free public presentation Saturday morning at 10:30 at Central Library, where he'll speak and sign books. His latest book is titled Between Them, Remembering My Parents. It's published by Echo. For more information on the award, visit tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.